Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-3161, United States of America versus Calvin McCants, appellant. Mr. Vernangus for the appellant, Mr. Swaney for the appellee.
May it please the court. Carlos Vernangus, Assistant Federal Public Defender on behalf of appellant Calvin McCants. This case is back before the court after the panel of this court remanded the case back to the district court for resentencing. Upon resentencing, the district court imposed the same exact sentence that it did during the first sentencing hearing. The district court found erroneously that the appellant was liable for a loss of $110,000 that was the criminal proceeds orchestrated by an individual by the name of Ricky Buchanan. Additionally, the district court erroneously found that the sophisticated means enhancement applied to the appellant's criminal conduct for the implements that he had. First, with respect to the relevant conduct, the district court started its analysis by invoking subsection 1B13A, and that is that the appellant was responsible as an aider and abettor. And the district court made findings in looking at the conduct and showing and affirming that the government had proved that the appellant had created these false identifications and had sold them to Ricky Buchanan, that he had also sold credit history to Ricky Buchanan, and that in some instances that he created false identifications with the true name of the victim, and that afterwards Ricky Buchanan went and committed bank fraud with his own co-conspirators. The problem with the district court's analysis is that it stops halfway through that guideline provision, and that it doesn't then deal with the issue of whether the relevant conduct, that is, the bank fraud, did it take place during the commission of the offense of conviction or in preparation for the offense of a conviction or in an effort to avoid detection or response.
And when did the offense of conviction occur? If we're looking at a temporal issue here, when something happened, when did that offense occur?
Well, based on the plea agreement, it would be December 12th, December 21st, and then of 2000, and then March 25th of 2000.
So it occurred only on those 3 days?
Yes. I mean, clearly.
Now, why didn't you make that point prior to your reply brief? In your opening brief, you cite the language of the statute during the commission of, but you don't make the point that it's significant that it only happened on these 3 days for the purposes of finding what happened during the commission of the convicted offense. You don't make that until your reply brief. Haven't you waived that argument?
No, I do not believe that it was waived, because by challenging the subsection and laying out the argument that, in fact, the offense of conviction takes place on certain enumerated dates, that is, based on the indictment of the plea agreement.
You didn't make that point to your reply brief, though, that the specific argument that during the commission of the offense of conviction means on one of 3 days. That argument, as I recall, didn't appear until your reply brief.
That's correct, Your Honor. It did not appear. And then specifically, I responded to the government, because the government took an expansive view as to when the offense of conviction took place. And so it was in response to that I said, well, if you're looking at that part of the provision, when the relevant conduct took place in reference to the commission of the offense, it had to take place on these three discrete dates. I believe that by not raising it in my initial brief, I don't believe that I waived the argument. I mean, I think it's implicit in that if the government is going to support and raise this type of analysis and request the district court to impose this enhancement based on this provision of the relevant conduct subsection, then it's incumbent on them to bring evidence to the court and say, well, you can tell, you can decide that, in fact, the appellant is liable because on these three dates, he was actually involved in the relevant conduct in which Ricky Buchanan was committing his fraud.
What do you do with the clauses relating to in preparation for that offense or in the course of attempting to avoid detection or responsibility?
I think that...
Surely, I mean, he had a business, right? He had an ongoing business. And on the periods between actual charged moments of possession, surely he was preparing for further possession, right? Hasn't he got to have been?
I think that certainly I'll start out my answer with the initial part of the question, and that is I think that there was no question that, in fact, it was done in an effort to avoid detection or responsibility. I think the more difficult issue is what Your Honor has stated, and whether he was, in fact, always in preparation for...
It seems to me if the related conduct, the alleged related conduct, occurred either in the preparatory phase with relation to any of the dates of possession, or in the avoiding detection phase with respect to any of the dates of possession, the guideline applies.
That's correct, but I believe there's no evidence with respect to avoiding detection or responsibility. I mean, there's no evidence.
Well, let's focus on preparation then. Well, I mean, that's sufficient.
Preparation would be sufficient, but there's no, again, you would have to look at the record evidence, and that is at what point the appellant was actually preparing, was in preparation for the offense of possession of implements.
If you're running a store for these things and you maintain an inventory, you're in continuous preparation for the moments that come along when you're having an inventory is useful to you. Of course, those are your sales. The dates of charged possession are not moments that were useful to him, clearly, but they seem to occur in a period when he is continually making sales and therefore using his inventory.
He is using his inventory, but the obstacle here for the government, at least, is that during the evidentiary hearings, there was no evidence, there was no testimony in relationship to these three discrete dates of which he pled guilty when he was actually preparing for the relevant conduct criminal activity.
Yeah, I mean, judges in making these findings, which are by a preponderance, can use their common sense, right?
They could, but I believe that if in this sentencing hearing went over at least 2 days, and it was exhaustive with respect to the special agent who testified and also Ricky Buchanan, and in the course of that testimony, it was never elicited question. There was never any testimony elicited when in reference to the bank fraud that was orchestrated and took place and directed by Ricky Buchanan. When in relationship to that activity, did he order his credit history or his identifications in order to go and be able to conduct that criminal activity? So I think the nexus is mixing. At least I agree with the court that there can be an expansive notion of temporal time in preparation. But
are you suggesting that it would be consistent with the evidence for Buchanan to have acquired all these identities long before the first charged act of possession? And that seems conceivable but highly implausible when you have, the frauds occurring over a 9-month period.
It is occurring over a nine-month period, but then when you look at these three discrete dates, and they basically cover a period of over a year and a half, and so clearly you cannot identify specifically when the criminal behavior is taking place in relationship to the discrete points in which the appellant pled guilty as to possessing these implements. I mean, I think that his criminal liability has to be limited both in terms of what is charged in an indictment when he pleads guilty of possessing these implements, and then I think the temporal component of the provision narrows it so that the appellant or the defendant cannot be kind of liable infinitum if there's no set parameters. And I think that that's the problem here, is that in the absence of any evidence or testimony to the contrary, then the appellant would just be liable for any conduct regardless of any limitations or parameters of time. So I believe that is the fundamental flaw with the government's analysis and also what the district court ruled. I mean, I think it would have been...
I just don't know the answer to this question. Is it ever the case that possession of this sort of thing is charged as occurring over an extended period? Would it ever be the case that the government would charge possession for the period from the first date to the last date?
Normally you don't see that, because in terms of possession, the government will charge in an indictment on or about a certain date. And if they want to charge a conspiracy, they can charge anywhere between a couple of days to a decade easily. I think that if the court had made findings that in fact this was part of a joint criminal enterprise or common scheme, we would be in a different posture. But the government did not argue in such a way, and the district court did not find that. I mean, the district court is basically giving him primary aiding and abetting liability, but that was not the way that the government proceeding at the evidentiary hearing, and the findings were not such that the court ruled in such a way, that is, that he is an aider and abetter and was part of a conspiracy. And having elected not to proceed in that direction and going to this provision, 1B1.3A1, it's limited then by the temporal component. It wouldn't have been limited by the other temporal component that's not existent in traditional aiding and abetting liability. I believe that, at this point, I think we'll go into sophisticated means. The problem with the sophisticated means is, one, we have an appellant who pleads guilty to possession of document-making implements, and he then is enhanced for sophisticated means essentially for having those implements. Now, the district court made findings that the implements were located in two office locations, in a hotel room and in a storage bin where he also had equipment. But that is a far cry from what the commentary calls, and looking at that is a sophisticated means especially intricate or complex in the execution or the concealment of the criminal conduct.
You don't think the concealment was sophisticated here? You had different locations, had a sort of a front company that appeared to be a legitimate company. You don't think that's
I think with the two office space, it gets close to it. Clearly, I believe that the hotel room and the storage bin are not part of it.
Do you know of any case in which a court of appeals has overturned a district court determination of sophisticated means? This is clear error, right?
It is clear error, Your Honor. No, I do not have a case on point or in mind.
I couldn't find one either.
Yes. Looking again at the record, at the evidentiary hearing, again, what the government did, the testimony that was elicited in great detail from the main witness, the special agent, he testified at length regarding the different machineries that the appellant had, what they could do. And clearly, he had very sophisticated machineries, and the district court also acknowledged or wrote that in the opinion that the appellant had books on how to work to use these machines and how to make the product even better. But if anything, that goes to show that the appellant needed the know-how, that he needed to learn how to use these machines. And so ultimately what you have is that the machines themselves bring the sophistication, and he didn't add anything to it other than just set them up in an assembly line. And by the end, he did produce a very good product. And looking at the testimony of Ricky Buchanan, at one point he basically says, this is what he did. He just basically pressed the button, he put in the paper, and then he had it laminated, and at the end he had a card. And so looking at the machines itself, yes, they're sophisticated, but then the concealment in two office spaces, ultimately when the police show up with a warrant, I mean, he's just sitting there. There was nothing sophisticated in the manner he was trying to hide. Your Honor, I think my time's up.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Stephen Sweeney for the United States. As I understand appellant's argument here today, he does not contest that he aided and abetted the bank fraud within the meaning of 1B1.3 Section A1A. He merely now contests that he did so during the commission of the offense. And as Judge Griffith pointed out, that argument was never clearly articulated in the appellant's opening brief. It was only first raised in the reply brief that during the commission of the offense is limited to the discrete moments in time when the search warrant was executed. And I'd also point out that that argument was not raised in the district court either. In response to that, it's clear that the aiding and abetting of the bank fraud did take place during the commission of the offense, as that language is used in the relevant sentencing guideline provision.
Do you insist on using the first of those three clauses?
No, Your Honor, and I think that those three clauses certainly work together to create
second and third considerably expand it beyond during.
Definitely, Your Honor, and certainly it creates a continuum in time, not just a discrete moment in time, as appellant suggests today. In fact, there's a law review article cited in appellant's reply brief that talks about this provision essentially creating a moving picture of the defendant's conduct over time. And so to take this during the commission of the offense language and argue that it's simply just a sort of a snapshot, a still moment in time, would result in an absurdity, really, because it would be both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. It would potentially sweep any criminal conduct that was going on at the same moment in time. And some of the cases appellant cites in his reply brief are particularly apt, and certainly...
Well, are you still insisting on during the commission of the offense as opposed to the last two clauses that Judge Williams directed you to?
No, Your Honor, but
you keep saying during the commission of the offense.
Well, I believe that...
One wonders whether you're insisting that that's where this rises and falls, as opposed to in preparation and the last clause.
I'm not insisting on that, Your Honor. I believe that it does fit within the plain meaning of that single part of the language during the commission of the offense, but certainly it falls within all three, in preparation for and in efforts to conceal it afterwards.
How does it fall within the during the commission?
Well, Your Honor,
the government's case is that this commission, the commission of this offense happened on 3 days, right? That's the case that you've put on, at three specific days, and yet you've adduced no evidence to show that he aided and abetted the bank fraud during those 3 days.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I believe that the government's evidence showed that the possession of the document-making equipment went well beyond those 3 days. Now, those were the only 3 days in which appellant was searched and found to be in possession. However, Mr. Buchanan testified that he obtained the documents that he used to perpetrate the loan fraud, specifically with the 11 transactions that are detailed in the
The offenses of conviction were stuck with the 3 days the government charged, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that during the commission of the offense is broader than just the specific moment in time that the defendant is found to be in possession.
I'm not talking about the whole clause, but the offense, surely the offenses are those 3 days, right?
Well, again, Your Honor, I don't believe that the during language is limited to that specific moment in time, because
you have to tell us when it was, and those are the only dates that you've told us it was.
Well, I believe that...
I mean, the burden's on the government here to explain when. And the government has chosen to say it happened on 3 days. I mean, I don't see anything in your case that tells us when it was he was in possession of these tools beyond those 3 days.
Well, certainly he had to be in possession of the equipment in order to manufacture the false documents that he sold to Mr. Buchanan to perpetrate the loan fraud.
Why couldn't he have done it on those 3 days? I mean, common sense suggests otherwise, but that's not the case you've put on.
Well, I believe that, as Judge Williams suggested, the courts, as the trier of fact, could certainly use his common sense.
Well, we can't go but so far. If you have a burden of proof, you've got to... I'm just utterly perplexed as to why you continue to insist on the first clause, which creates terrible problems for you, and you say you don't really, and then you continue to argue it.
Well, simply...
You don't have a good case there, and I'm not aware of any authority one way or another. You're not citing any. You're just saying it's common sense.
Well, Your Honor, I was simply trying to respond to the questions, but again...
One of the ways to respond was to say, we really don't mean to rest on it. If we have a case one day, we think we could show it. We don't really have it here. That's true. And so we would rest on the second two clauses. But if you want to insist, we can take it on those terms and see what we do with it.
Well, Your Honor, I believe we're resting on the language of the section as a whole, frankly, and what the language of that section is intended to do.
The totality of the circumstances.
I mean, precision really works in this court. I don't know about other courts, and there are three clauses here, and I'm not sure why you're fighting against two clauses which appear to be apt and going to this totality stuff. It's nonsense. You know, if you don't have it there, that's not to suggest you couldn't make it out in some other case. It's to suggest that we're not seeing it here. And so the second two clauses, it seems to me, is what you would want to flesh out if you have the case there.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that, as I stated, the first clause in preparation certainly applies. Obviously, in preparation for the possession of the document-making implements, which was more than simply possession, as Judge William pointed out, it was essentially an entire factory to make multiple different kinds of false identity documents, from identification cards to W-2s to Social Security cards, income tax statements, and the like. So in preparation for that offense, which even conceding that it only occurred on the three dates that the search warrants were executed, certainly the appellant engaged in all kinds of conduct to prepare for that offense. He had to obtain the equipment. He had official seals from different jurisdictions, which certainly aren't readily available on the internet, as appellant suggests the other equipment was. So certainly had to take a lot of steps to get to the point where he had all that equipment and had it in such a way and had constructed this factory to use it in order to make what Agent Porter testified were essentially the highest quality false identity documents that money could buy. And so in preparation for the offense, obviously he had to do all of these things. And in addition, Your Honor, Mr. Buchanan testified that he, for those 11 transactions, he obtained all the documents that he needed in order to perpetrate the bank fraud from appellant, including the August 2000 and the January 2001 bank frauds, which occurred just before and just after the search warrants were executed and appellant was found to be in possession of that equipment. So clearly in preparation for the commission of the offense applies. And in terms of concealment.
And let me back up. Maybe I'm missing something. I'm looking at the language of relevant conduct here. That was 1B1.3A. And as I understand it, what we're supposed to be looking for are acts and omissions that aided and abetted, in this case, the bank fraud that occurred in preparation for the offense of possession of the tools, right? Help me understand that. What are the actions that were taken that aided and abetted the bank fraud and that were taken in preparation for the offense of possessing these tools?
Well, Your Honor, as I stated, I believe the acquisition of all of these items, as well as appellant suggested, the education, the ability to gain the knowledge and ability to actually make these identity documents. And to be sure, there's only one reason for having all of these false document-making machines, and that is to make false identity documents. And as we know, appellant had no legitimate reason to have these machines. It wasn't as if he was running a legitimate business, which she then was using these machines on the side for illegal purposes. And his sole purpose was to create false identity documents. And his sole purpose in creating false identity documents was to sell them to people to use for illegal purposes. And here, he knew full well when he sold those documents to Mr. Buchanan that Mr. Buchanan was going to use them to perpetrate a bank fraud. And it's also clear that the appellant intended to help him make the bank fraud succeed. He told him what documents he would need in order to get the loans. He told him how to have his associates behave in the bank in order to assure the repeated success of the fraud. And so the relevant conduct provision, the goal there is to allow the district court to address the full range of harms that flow from the defendant's offense conduct. It's not meant to anchor the court to the specific charge in the indictment to which the defendant pled guilty, or the charging language, or the exact elements of the offense. It's meant to implement the real offense principles that the guidelines have set out.
In any of these possession of contraband cases, does the government ever charge a period? I mean, as appellant's counsel mentioned, you have conspiracy charges, which of course always involve a period. But I was wondering, for just a plain possession charge, is there ever a charge for possession over a period? And if not, why not?
I'm not aware, Your Honor. I couldn't say certainly whether there's never been. I think it would be unusual. As appellant's counsel pointed out, typically it's charged as an on or about a certain date, simply probably because that makes it the easiest to prove that the defendant actually possessed the item, because the proof...
Would it be a fatal variance if you stated a period and then were missing 1 month out of 12?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I think, as Your Honor pointed out earlier, certainly the possession was ongoing over time. And we know that because we have Buchanan's testimony that he obtained these false identity documents from appellant, and that he was in appellant's office and witnessed him actually using these document-making implements to fabricate the false identity documents, which he then sold to Buchanan. So again, while the proof in the sense of being caught was only on these certain days, we do have Mr. Buchanan's testimony in which he testified that he saw appellant in possession of these machines on prior occasions. And certainly the reasonable inferences from Mr. Buchanan's testimony that he bought these IDs from appellant and used them in the bank frauds indicates that appellant was in possession of them over a period of time. And so we're going back to the standard of review here. Obviously, this is clear error in terms of the court determining what is or is not relevant conduct, and at least due deference in terms of applying the guidelines to what the court has determined to be relevant conduct. And I don't believe that there is any showing here that the court clearly erred, or that there's any showing that that due deference wouldn't apply here. And I just like to briefly address the sophisticated means argument. An appellant stated in his argument today that it was a close call. And again, going back to the standard of review, this is a clear error standard of review. And if it's a close call, even in an appellant's view, certainly there would be no basis for finding clear error. And as Judge Griffith pointed out, and a point that I had planned to make, was that appellant has not cited a single case, and the government is aware of no case in which a court has overturned a finding of sophisticated means. All appellant has done is to gather a number of cases and say that these involved means that were more sophisticated, arguably, than...
If the alleged sophisticated means are inherent in the charged crime, are you able to double up there?
No, Your Honor, but I don't believe that there is necessarily sophistication inherent in this charged offense, simple possession of document-making equipment, which could be anything from a laminating machine to a computer program. It doesn't necessarily mean that the execution of the offense is going to be sophisticated. And what we have here not only was appellant's use of the machinery sophisticated, because as Agent Porter testified, he was able to make extremely high-quality documents. His concealment of the offense was extremely sophisticated. He used multiple locations in multiple jurisdictions. He used false identities to rent the locations where he stored this equipment. He employed a Confederate or an employee to help him manage the scheme. So there were several other steps that were taken
that
were
extensive or sophisticated.
It's sophisticated, Your Honor.
None of what you said sounded terribly sophisticated. It just sounded like it was elaborate.
Well, elaborate and sophisticated are certainly related, but I believe
the same thing.
They're not the same thing, but they are probably
really nothing tricky about having several locations.
Well, there's nothing necessarily inherently tricky about it,
there's
but when
sophisticated about it.
Well, I believe
an
it is.
An average person could get several locations without thinking much about it.
I believe all that the enhancement requires, Your Honor, is that there were additional steps taken beyond the ordinary steps that would be taken to conceal the offense. And the use of false identities, for example, which Mr. McCants used to rent the storage space using false identities that he created on his machinery, I think will qualify as sophistication. We simply ask the court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Does Mr. Venegas have any time? We'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
I would ask the court to remand this case back to the district court for the reasons I stated, but ultimately what we have is the appellant who entered a guilty plea to possessing document-making implements on three discrete dates. As beyond his liability for that, the government's evidence did not meet the standards either for the relevant conduct provision and neither for the sophisticated means provision. The multiple jurisdictions and the multiple locations amounts to just two separate sites. The fact that he used an alias to obtain a space in a storage facility, that did not go towards concealing his criminal conduct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.